Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, January 24th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Today's guest speaker will be Robert Houston, the director of the Nebraska Department of Correctional Services. He will talk about the current condition of Nebraska's prisons and some of the changes that have been enacted during the past 25 years. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Chris Allen, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Allen. I'm an associate professor at the University of Nebraska at Omaha School of Communication, and I have the pleasure of moderating this afternoon's Press Club Forum. Once a month, the Press Club, through its Education Committee, sponsors a forum of interest to club members and the community at large. The forums are open to everyone. You do not have to be a member of the Press Club to attend, and we invite everyone to come and join us for our lunchtime meetings. A story in the Omaha World Herald several months ago noted that the Nebraska prison population was down about 2% in recent years. The Nebraska Department of Corrections runs, as far as I can tell, 10 facilities. Bob can correct me if I'm wrong, around the state, including the State Penitentiary in Lincoln, the Omaha Correctional Center, and the Community Correctional Youth Facility here in the city. The director of the Department of Corrections is Bob Houston, and he is our guest today. Mr. Houston is a graduate of the University of Nebraska at Omaha and has a master's degree from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. He began working for the state penitentiary in 1974 as a counselor. He has risen through the system and over the years has served as warden of the Omaha Correctional Facility, the Nebraska Correctional Facility in Lincoln, and the Correctional Youth Facility here. He was hired as director of the Douglas County Correctional Center in April 2003 and implemented a number of procedures and policies that brought some order to that facility that had been troubled for several years. In March of 2005, Governor Dave Heineman appointed him director of the Nebraska Department of Corrections. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bob Houston.
Well, good afternoon. I was worried when I first started talking to Chris here to make sure I wasn't standing between you and food, and I see that's not the case, so I'm much more comfortable addressing you. And what I'd like to do is 20 or 25 minutes or so of discussion and so forth, and then followed by question and answer. But before we get started, I guess what I'd like to ask for, hello, Michael. Are there any, like, burning questions that you have to make certain that I include that in my presentation here or in soon after in the question answer, or any stereotypes about prisons and so forth, how you doing, that you think I ought to address? Gary? No? No? Bill?
We'll get to it later.
All right. Okay. Well, good. Well, you know, I think having been or being part of the media, you're probably much better versed on corrections and prisons than the public is. Some real quick facts about the Department of Corrections. We're the second largest agency in terms of people in the state. We're the largest criminal justice agency in the state. We have just under 2,400 employees, and we run 10 facilities. Chris was right. Also, we have the state parole officers are under the Department of Corrections, and then also industries. The industries program statewide in our institutions is also under the Department of Corrections. As a director, I have five deputy directors, one for industries, one for medical, one for fenced and walled facilities, one for community services, and one for administrative services. And then each of them have their wardens and their program heads that we have spread throughout the state. We are credited by the American Correctional Association. In August, we won the Eagle Award, which is in the history of accreditation, which goes back several decades. Only 13 of those awards have been given out, and we were the number 10 winner of that last summer. And what that means is we have all of our facilities and all of our programs accredited by the American Correctional Association. So why is that important? The importance of that is that that's the vehicle that we use and we hold dear to our hearts to make certain that we have the nation's best prisons, the safest prisons, and those that hit all operational aspects of our institutions. Now, they don't do our accounting procedures or things such as that. We have internal and also the state auditors that keep us on the right track when it comes to business and finance. But it hits all our operation levels concerning segregation, protective custody, how much out-of-cell time there is, exercise. And then it also causes us to review our policies and procedures every year to make certain that those are up to date and refreshed as needed. What I'd really like to talk to you about today is really just kind of get down to a gut level, what it's like to work inside of a prison or a jail. Connie Nimix is here. She's our public information officer. And Connie, like I think we're the only ones in the department that have been both line staff members and supervisors in county jails, as well as line Department of Corrections employees and supervisors in the department. So we're kind of birds of a feather in that respect. And Connie is also our public information officer, and she is also our legislative liaison, which is her main. She's our hookup to the legislature and to the governor's policy research office. So, and Connie, when we get down to the gut level, I'm going to ask her to talk about what it's like to be a woman working inside of an all-male prison. Do you think that's something that you can comment on?
Yes.
So we'll get to that. But what I guess, and then also I want to indicate what we have up here. We've got more calendars, so you can, I didn't bring them soon enough for you to have those as the stocking stuffers, although you could have them next year, but they'd be dated. Then we also have Connie's cards there as anything that you have, thing that you have concerning public information or legislative liaison or basically anything that concerns the department, you can call Connie. And then we have a little brochure there that is kind of an overview of the Department of Corrections. And then we have, interestingly here, and I didn't bring enough manuals for you, this is how we train our public information officers to talk to you, okay, which I thought you might find interesting. And so we'll leave those booklets with you. And if you need more, Chris, well, we can get you more of those booklets. And then this is the statistics sheet that that we put out on a monthly basis, and it goes through each institution what the cost is per inmate per year at that facility. And you can see it varies considerably between facilities, and I'll explain that in a few minutes. And then it hits other things, such as this one I think has drug usage. When we got into a serious crackdown on drug usage 17 years ago, at any time when you if you were to test 100 inmates in our population, 18 of them would have been had substance in their bloodstream, whether it be alcohol or drugs of some sort. And now that can jump around just because one or two inmates, but the average is probably below 2% if you look across all the confined facilities. What draws it up a little bit, of course, is people on parole, people in our community centers, because obviously they have access to the outside. We've really cracked down on drugs by a lot of things. One is by staff training, by having internal investigators that investigate things not only as personnel cases, but then also as criminal issues, if staff or visitors were to bring drugs into the institution. We also have 5 drug dogs, and we have random, and we have targeted drug testing. And so it has made a tremendous difference in the safety of our institutions. Overall, our prisons nationwide are probably have about 10 to 15% each year of the violence that we had 25 years ago. Even though prisons have more people, are more crowded, we have less violence now than we had 25 years ago. And the reason for that is that we've become very professional organizations across the country. The American Correctional Association has had a lot to do with that. But it has really been an improvement in many ways. We have now a more professional way that we approach our classification. Our classification systems are now put together on a risk basis. They're scientific based rather than what we think is the best way to put somebody at high security, medium security, or low security. We have Dr. Patricia Hardiman from the Criminal Justice Institute that put together our classification system. We also have internal classification systems that are being developed. How do we separate inmates inside based upon their risk? And so those approaches have made things much safer, because when you get inmates around other inmates that look just like them, they kind of cancel each other out. It's when you have mismatches in your inmate population, have people that are close to being in the community, for example, around people that are doing lots of time, that makes for a difficult situation for that inmate that's close to getting out. So we've taken a much better approach towards how we classify inmates, how we monitor inmates, how we keep the prison safe. What I want to talk a little bit about is things that you would see in the media, events that would occur, and how that relates to how we see we need to run the agency and so forth. And Chris, and I mentioned to Chris briefly before we got started here, is that we really, in corrections, not just in Nebraska, but we spend a lot of time on looking at our staff culture and our inmate culture. And the reason for that is that a lot of what we realize is a lot of what goes on inside of institutions is based upon the culture that you've developed with your staff and how they interact with inmates. For a lot of years, I think we spent a lot of time studying the inmates, and that's still important to study the inmates. But I think more recently, and the involvement of UNO has been outstanding, is that the academic world is now coming into the practitioner world and looking at how we govern inmates rather than and how we behave as staff, and how we are professional as staff is much more telling about the safety of an institution rather than what we think the inmates are going to do. And so you can take the most dangerous inmates in the world, which is what you would have probably in Florence, Colorado, in the federal system, or in our high security units in Nebraska and elsewhere, and you can govern those almost incident-free as far as serious assaults on staff. Now, they can happen. We still have uses of force and that type of thing, but it's an extremely controlled environment, and that has made institutions so much safer. And I know that Pelican Bay in California, you probably heard of that, took a lot of criticism and has taken a lot of criticism. Some of it, things that they need to look at and tinker with and make certain. But when you consider what Pelican Bay has done across the California system that has huge issues, it's made that system, albeit that they have a long way to go to be where Nebraska's at, it's made it much safer by being able to sort out those people that are strictly predatory. And that's how they envision their whole world, from those people who just want to do their time, which is about 85 to 90% of our inmates just want to come in and do their time. And it's probably like your students, isn't it, Bill, that you spend 95% of your time on 5%? So, well, that's right. Inmates are about the same way. Now, I must say before I go on that Gary Kerr is here, and I was just telling Chris, you were just really a help to me during your career, having me on your talk shows and when you covered corrections issues, being very fair. We never got – not that I'm biased towards Channel 6, but I always watch Channel 6. And also Carlos Barrientos being there was a help. But you were always very fair to us, and I appreciate that. And so it's a privilege to talk to you today. The what it's like to be a correction officer, I think one of the things that you see that we have obviously different interests from the media when it comes to when you come and talk to us, it's almost like our world and your world can be much different. And the reason for it is that we think we're there for truth, honesty, and justice. And, of course, you come in and you want to inform the public. And what we become concerned about is not your responsibility to inform the public, but what topics you might pick to inform the public on and how things can sometimes get highlighted more than we think in our world. But that's just the world it is. And that's why we train our public information officers to have a little bit better idea of what the business model is that that you have when you come talk to us and the business model that we need to have when we respond to you. The we have events that happen in our institutions, and we do everything we can to prevent those events from happening. But one of the things that you can be proud of in Nebraska Corrections, and I certainly can't take credit for this, it's the credit of all 2,375 staff that we have, is that we have an underlying system of quality and a good culture and excellent communication between staff and inmates. And that's what underlies everything that we do. And that's why we spend so much time, as I talked about earlier, on culture. And why that is so important is that with culture, with concentration on culture, you have events that occur. But the events that occur are isolated, usually isolated decisions, bad decisions by a staff member or by a inmate that reflects bad decision-making on their part and has far less to do with an underlying culture that supports that type of behavior. We had that at one time, and we know that that could come back if we don't pay attention to it every day, every hour, every minute. Because something that is that, especially when you're running high control facilities, that the difference between a very supportive, very positive culture and that becomes negative and sarcastic and so forth is only about a 3 or 4 degree turn. And we want to make certain we never make that 3 or 4 degree turn, because we were there 15, 20 years ago. And we believe we're not there now. Let me give you an incident that just happened recently. And this is a typical incident. We had a use of force situation a few months ago at Tecumseh. And when we do a use of force, what the officers do, it's usually in a controlled unit, in our high security unit at Tecumseh or one of our administrative confinement areas in one of our institutions, is you'll have an inmate who decides that he's going to have a bad day, and he's going to make certain that you have a bad day also. And so they'll cover their window, or they will break up their tray into what is a weapon or seems like a weapon, or do things of self-harm that causes us to have to go in and take them out. Now, we don't just open up the door and say, "Would you please come with me?" because we know that he's not going to please come with us. So we have what's called a cell extraction team. And we line up. We have a shield person, and then right arm, left arm, right leg, left leg. And that's so we have 5 people on the team. And the shield person is to nail that person against the wall, take him to the floor, because all safety in correctional institutions, as in law enforcement, it starts from the pavement or the concrete up. Okay. As soon as we get people to the ground, we can then control things in a safe way. And that's what our cell extraction team does. Well, while they had the inmate down and had the inmate cuffed up, one of our officers who had been spat upon or bit by this inmate took 4 punches at this person in their back. Now, they didn't leave marks. They didn't cause damage to that person or anything such as that. But immediately that team wrote incident reports on the person they work with day in and day out, wrote incident report on that individual. That's something that wouldn't have happened 20, 25 years ago. And I was so proud of that team and so proud of that institution, that was at Tecumseh, that they would report that. Now, that needs to be reported. And that staff member was dealt with. I believe that staff member was terminated. But that's the type of thing that we didn't have 25 years ago that's so important that we have, that anything that they do beyond the control of that inmate is wrong. Anything they say to that inmate during a use of force situation, everybody's told you will not speak except for the commander. It'll only be instructions. Anything you say is wrong. Everything is recorded, and everything is under videotape. Now, this wouldn't have been videotaped, this part of it, because the use of force was over at that point. We had another situation where we had an inmate who gets medication out of a bottle, and a staff member tampered with that bottle. And the inmates said, he tampered with my bottle. And we said, well, no, let's do an investigation. And one of our other staff members, the only other person working there, instead of saying, no, I didn't see it, he says, yep, he did it. And that guy causes his problems, and he's going to get us hurt if he keeps doing that. We had another situation where we had a canister of water that the inmates used to make coffee. And one officer thought it would be funny to put some Visine in there. And the other officer says, what are you doing? You know, because they heard that would give him diarrhea, not hurt him and that type of thing. What are you doing? And he says, well, I don't want to hurt him. Well, the officer says, you leave. And he dumped it out, and he scrubbed it out, filled it up, and then served it to the inmates. Both those cases, the staff members were fired for that. Because there isn't such a thing in our world as a little bit of corruption. There isn't those things. There are some things that, you know, if you fail to do a count correctly and you report it and we get it corrected, you're going to get a verbal counseling or something such as that. There are things mistakes you can make as far as relationships are concerned. You know, not reporting relationships on the outside, not sexual relationships or anything like that, that we can see our way past. But when it comes to those things that are corrupting, especially if a staff member is trying to shade the truth or hide the truth, we can't tolerate. And it's those types of actions that make for the type of culture that we believe we have in the department, where it's honest, it's transparent, and that when we hear things, we can honestly report those to you, because we can report about the incident, and we worry a lot less about any underlying culture that would cause that incident to happen. So those are the things that we hold dear. Now, there's a lot of operational things that we have to do to get there. Many of them I've described. But also, it's important to understand the world in which our staff members work. Connie and I both worked line positions for a lot of years. And when you're a police officer, a fireman, or whatever you do, during the normal workday, you're going to find some place where you can go to write your reports, to spend a few minutes, and so forth, and you're away from what you're doing every day. Our officers, we put them into a housing unit for 8 hours a day. They're constantly inmates there. If they're a yard officer, constantly inmates there. Now, you may get a break during count time, and then they're right back at you, and you're over in the dining room. When you communicate with your fellow staff members, you've got the inmates there. You've got questions, comments. You may get called because there's a disruption, somebody getting loud, a fight. You got to go for that fight. I mean, we have some staff members that when you come to work, you know that the probability of you know, we've had times, the probability of you being in a physical confrontation are about 100% each day you come to work, if you're on the right shift and working the right posts. And so that's very difficult mentally. But how we make up for that is we make up for that with low pay. And then we also make certain that you got to work when your family's off, and you get the wonderful days of Tuesday, Wednesday off. So that really kind of makes up for those harsh, those sometimes harsh working environments and so forth. And so it's really very challenging for staff to work in corrections. Now, we have our highest turnover. You hear a lot about turnover in corrections. It's usually at our entry level, our first level positions. And a lot of that turnover is people being promoted because, you know, some people at the higher levels, you know, if I were to leave, that opens up 13 promotions. So, you know, one person leaving can open up a lot of promotions and so forth. But some of it is that people just say, you know, this just isn't for me. I mean, this just really isn't the environment for me. But once they promote up a little bit where the money gets better and they've put some time in and so forth, then the turnover goes down considerably. We don't have a warden that has less than 20 or 25 years of corrections experience. We do?
Barb.
Okay. She only has about 11 years. Okay, we got one 11 years. You got me there. But most of them are 20 and 25 years. Well-educated. We have PhDs and Juris Doctorates among our wardens and master's degrees and so forth. And well-intended people do a very good job. But but working in the institution is just day after day types of things. Now, what's interesting is one thing that's hitting the media now and will be has to do with PREA, the Prison Rape Elimination Act. In Nebraska and in many states, Nebraska following suit, it's a felony to have sex with an inmate. It doesn't matter. You know, there's no such thing as the inmate giving compliance because the inmates, the thinking in the law is they're in a coercive environment. And so it's not a fair exchange between us and an inmate. And that's one thing we really drill into the staff when they come, that if you think that this is going to be a back-and-forth relationship like you had in high school or in college or you have with your family and so forth, you're wrong. It's not going to happen that way because there's always a power difference because you're the staff member and this person's locked up. And when you're locked up, I mean, it's just like we can enjoy the meal here and everything else, but if Chris went over there and locked the door and said, I'm not going to tell you till tomorrow when you're going to get out of here, it would change everything, wouldn't it? I mean, it'd change how the meals taste, how comfortable the seats are, and how your interactions are, and this beautiful view is, geez, I'm tired of looking out this window. You know, it changes everything. And so relationships aren't the same inside the institution as they are on the out. So that's a very, very good law that Senator Chambers originated. You're going to be seeing in the newspaper before too long, and we'll come back to the sexual contact we have at the Omaha Correctional Center, is what is called PREA, Prison Rape Elimination Act. And a nationwide survey was done by the Criminal Justice Institute. And what they did was they went in and they talked to inmates about their experience inside the institutions as far as sexual contact that they've observed or been part of between inmates or staff on inmates. And the whole thing relies upon the honesty of the inmates. And the whole thing is driven by all the problems that come with surveys. And so out of our 855 inmates at Tecumseh, 230 were called up. 85 of them agreed to be surveyed. All but 13%, they were good to go. And the 13%, which turns out to be about 9 people, reported an incredible amount of sex between staff and inmates, which put Tecumseh at the higher end of the survey. Well, I talked to Alan Beck, who Bill, you're probably familiar with him with Bureau of Justice Statistics, and he said the statistics are very fragile, and the probability that was a valid survey, there was about a 21% chance that was merely by chance rather than by design, and there was no validation of the statistics itself. That aside, we are leading the country in our adapting PREA standards, pre-investigations, professional instruments about how we sort out inmates. Because in our world, it really doesn't matter to us whether or not we agree with criticism that we receive from any venue. What matters to us is there something in here that's going to cause us to be safer and to keep the public safer? And so we look beyond anything that we think might be unfair criticism and so forth and go, you know, we're going to get ahead of this. And so we just, in fact, Connie just made application today for us to be one of 10 institutions that the PREA committee will come into and test out the standards that they have, the safety standards that they have. So here we are out there being, we think, randomly selected out there to look. And there's a lot of institutions around the country that are being looked at the same way we are. But at the same time, it doesn't matter whether or not we agree with the criticism. What matters is, hey, you know what? There's something in here that can improve our operations and our safety even more. And so we're going to embrace it and continue to be the nation's leader on that and develop our internal classification efforts and so forth. So there we go. I guess I want to leave it at that and leave plenty of time for question and answer. So,
thank you.
Okay.
All righty, I have a number of questions. If you'd like to ask a question, Please write them on the paper at your table and pass them forward. So I already had a few, and I have dozens here in my hand, and Gary is collecting more. So I'll try to sort through some of these. And actually, there are a couple that are related. Let's see if I can put a few of them together. Several dealing with the incidents of drugs, and so let me kind of consolidate them. One question asks how drugs and alcohol find their way into prison, and assuming that they do. Approximately what percentage of your population are drug addicts or meth users, and what sorts of programs do you have to deal with those problems, alcohol and drug abuse?
Okay, good. And I think this sheet. Oh, this is on recidivism rate. It's not on the drug. Or is it on the other side? Is it the drug?
No, I don't.
That's recidivism.
Recidivism.
I think that was the previous one.
Oh, okay. Well, let me address alcohol first. When I started in the prison system in 1974, it was very violent working at the penitentiary. But we just figured that's the way it is, and so alcohol was not treated seriously. I mean, we literally had inmates walking down the sidewalks that were staggering, and what would happen is they'd be taken to their cell, locked in their cell, and then let out the next morning. Well, we don't take that approach anymore. That was before marijuana started coming into the institution. But the alcohol is generally made inside of institutions, and and that's where our constant security searches are at. And usually what they'll do is they'll take a piece of bread, stuff it into a bottle, and then go to the commissary and buy some juice and some other things and pour it in there and then find a warm spot to put it in, okay? Now, I don't know if you're home brewers, if you've made wine or not, but this is like butchery at the best when it comes to it. But it'll come out like 8, 9, 10%. I don't know what it is. Maybe more than that. Yeah. Yeah. All the better. Isn't wine 12%? Something like that?
Something like that, and very, very chunky.
Yes. Yeah, and it's called Pruno. And when the officers get the Pruno, of course, they take it to the head of security's office, and they lock it in that person's office and leave the lid off just a little bit. So when the head of security walks in on Monday morning, with the evidence tags and everything else, okay. We have very few instances of alcohol anymore. Our search procedures, and that not just in Nebraska, are so much better than they ever were in the history of corrections and so forth. So it does happen. We do get alcohol in now and then. We had an assault, a serious assault, at the Lincoln Correctional Center about 6 months ago, two guys that were drunk. And, not 6 months ago, it was in October. And so it's a real serious problem. I mean, we take alcohol probably more seriously. I mean, we take them all seriously, but even more seriously than the others, not just because of the presence of it, but because how the inmates respond once they're drunk. And now, as far as the other drugs are concerned, the use of drugs, as I indicated earlier, is real low, and not just in Nebraska, but nationwide, but particularly low here. And then I gave also the reasons for it with our searches and our drug dogs and that type of thing. Now, I once got a lawsuit at the Omaha Correctional Center from an inmate who said that. We allowed drugs to be snuck into the Omaha Correctional Center, and instead of bringing treatment to them, we brought the wrath of our security force upon them. And the drugs were in the institution at the level that any reasonable person, this is a lawsuit, that any reasonable inmate would find the temptation level to be so high that they couldn't resist using the drugs. Okay, so now even though that's kind of a little bit of amusement and so forth, there's a molecule of truth in that. And that is, if you have the availability in the institutions around people that have a history of drug and alcohol, you're going to have problems. You know, you just are. The Adams studies that we had through UNO, are fabulous. I mean, they were that was a fabulous study, and I'm so sorry the federal money ran out on that. And Vince Webb and your graduate students would get down to the Omaha Police Station, and when the inmates would come in, they would interview them. They would find out, first of all, and I think they would probably do it the next day after they slept some of it off, but they would then interview them within a particular amount of time, whether or not they were in drugs and alcohol when they came in, and whether or not they committed their crime under the influence of drugs or alcohol. And I think it was probably somewhere in the 90-95% were either under the influence of drugs or alcohol when they committed the crime or had an addiction to one or the other. Well, only about 4 or 5% of people that go to jail ever end up in prison. But, you know, as luck would have it, we still get that 95% that have drug or alcohol addictions. Most recently, and this is a point of pride for the, I think for the state of Nebraska, but also for UNO. I keep mentioning UNO, don't I? And it's not just because Bill's here, because if Bill was here, I'd still be mentioning UNO, because it's not only a point of pride for me having gone to school there and had Bill as my graduate school professor, but also UNO. In fact, the governor's office said to me, "Why is UNO so good and so responsive to things that we want to do?" And I told BJ Reed that and so forth. And the but UNO did the mess study for Nebraska under Dr. Hank Robinson. And I think there were several disciplines that were called into that to do that study. Well, it came out as a very comprehensive study. And the recommendations in there were right on target. And how the recommendations, it affected statewide, both in how you raise mental health workers as opposed to substance abuse counselors. It's a whole different cultures between substance abuse and mental health counselors as to how they become, how they get their education and their skills and so forth to do that. And so the UNO study is trying to look at the qualifications for people to do that job, okay? But the other thing they had in there was that Nebraska needs to address the population inside, because when you have them captured and doing residential substance abuse, you're already paying $27,000 a year, as you'll see in here, for the inmate. So if you add some resources onto that while they're a captured population, it'll not only lower the cost of having serious intervention for substance abuse, but it will also lower the probability that the inmates are going to come back to prison. And so with that study, instead of building the institution that was recommended, we got a letter from Dr. Robinson to the governor, because the governor asked me if Hank would write that letter, that supported our, what we call, the World Herald called Plan B, and we endorsed Plan B. We took the media and used that as Plan B, where instead of hiring the 95 staff it would take to run a small institution, we said, let us hire 36 staff and get $200,000 more resources for our community people and add that to our substance abuse and our mental health approaches. And so we did that. And we would have never been able to do it had it not been for UNO's study. What that means is that by July of 2009, for my population, hopefully they'll stay at 4,423 inmates, we will have nearly 140 professional psychiatrists, clinical psychologists, mental health workers, and substance abuse counselors. Of that, about 75, 77, somewhere in that number, are going to be substance abuse counselors, which means that we will be better resourced than any prison system in the country. Now, does that translate into nobody's going to come back to prison? Obviously not. But we are going to move from 232 beds of residential 10-month programs, 5 months to 10-month program living, which is far exceeds what someone would get in the community, up to 416 beds, which means that if our prison population doesn't grow, 10% of all the inmates we have at any one time are going to be in residential beds, in residential level. And by residential level, I mean health and human services level of programming. And that's huge. And then another 15% or possibly 20%, depending on how the numbers are going to work out, they're going to be in outpatient, serious outpatient programs. And then in addition to that, now that we are working so closely with probation and through the Community Corrections Council, we now have the day reporting centers that our parolees can access through the voucher system, follow-up treatment. And so it's what it's turned into, and what UNO recommended, is the perfect mental model. And that is what Dr. Robinson says. When a criminal defendant is standing in front of the judge should only have one decision that he or she needs to make, and that is, does this person need to be confined for the safety of the public? Because what interventions follow, whether they be in Health and Human Services or on probation or in the prison system, should all be very similar. Not going to be the same, different clients, but very similar. So we have the same evaluations that we use, and we have the same approaches towards treatment. So it's a seamless approach towards drug and substance abuse that then flows from the prison system into the community or from the community into the prison system. So that's a long answer to a short question.
Well, I have more. We're not going to get through all of them, but I have more. In the last couple of months, we had an incident in Omaha, and actually the police lockup facility in which an inmate died because he didn't get proper medical attention. What are the policies in place at the state penitentiary system to assure that the inmates get the medical attention they need? What are your guidelines? Are there standards to the system? And approximately what's the cost of that, of providing those medical services?
For medical services, we call it health care, we spend about $33 million a year. Our budget is $153 million. I shouldn't say that. I should have an exact number. People thinking, you lost track of $1 million. But right at $152 million a year, and about $33 million is spent on medical care. In our budget, we have about $27 million. Then we spend $4 or $5 million for a private contract that we have at our Tecumseh facility. So I'm going to lose track of the question. So the question is, what happened in the city lockup? What do we do to prevent things like that from happening? Well, one thing is that prisons are markedly different than jails as far as where the inmate is at. In a jail, when a person comes in, they're right off the streets. They're probably drunk. They're probably under the influence of drugs, as we talked about earlier. And their whole world has fallen apart on them. And their medical conditions have not been checked. There's not any, there hasn't been a physical conducted on that person. And so really what you have is what rolled in off the street into the back of a cruiser and down to the police station. So when you start with that premise as to what you have locked up there, and then you look at the resources the Omaha Police Jail has, and that is no medical services. The police officers taking them to the police station, having them booked in and getting back out to the streets is very important in the Omaha police culture. And processing the people in and have a proper booking and so forth is extremely important. And so the emphasis is there, as it should be, but what hasn't been emphasized has been the supervision of the prisoners once they're there. And that's why merging the city jail with the Douglas County Corrections is really something that needs to happen to prevent those types of things. When they get into the prison system, they have gone through the jails. They have, and now we're going to hook in with the jails to find out what physicals they do and what type of checks they have, so it goes right into our system. But we've done all the things I indicated that this city jail just isn't able to do. They've accepted, the fact they're going to be incarcerated. Their medical has been checked. They've been classified properly, and they're under the constant supervision of our staff. And when we have somebody who, might be a threat or is a medical and so forth, we have hospitals. We have nurses, 24-hour care nurses. We just have interventions that are well beyond what the Omaha Police Department had there. Now, the comments that jail officer is alleged to have said, I don't know if another staff member had heard that or not. It might have been the comments of an inmate. I really think that the people working the Omaha Police Department that was a bad incident, but you've got really good people working there. But the circumstances in which they work, the resources they have at hand, are not what they need to do their job properly. And also, there's a huge difference between law enforcement and corrections. And in the prison system, I think we are farther into the corrections continuum in that we are keepers and not catchers. Most of our staff, they don't even want to know what a guy's in for because they want to treat everybody the same. And so we know that taking care of a person, regardless of what they did 5 minutes before, is inconsequential, what the person did to get there. What's important is we have a human being that's locked up, and we're going to tend to their needs. So,
what are your thoughts on new legislation that would that would prohibit life sentences for juveniles convicted of serious crimes?
I have somewhat mixed feelings about that. I haven't worked very much with juveniles. My experiences with Lancaster County Jail and with our agency with the adults and not with our youth facility. I think there's some merit, and I understand the passion behind what's been introduced with that particular bill. I do have concerns that some of the juveniles perhaps should be treated as adults, and that's a personal view that I hold. But I do understand the passion behind it and wanting to give what's considered children, really, and what should be children, an opportunity to understand the magnitude of perhaps a crime they've committed and make changes. They're at a certain stage in development where they may be able to do that.
Here's a short question for you, either one of you. What's the average per day cost of housing an inmate?
Look on the back of the sheet here. I don't know if I have enough sheets for everybody. You'll see it varies from adult parole, which is $3,000 per year, up to Tecumseh's. No, the women's facility is more expensive, isn't it?
Youth facility.
Just under $60,000 a year. Yeah, $54,000 at the youth facility. A lot of that's driven by the economy of scale. And the youth facility, although that is expensive, I must tell you that institution is the model for the nation when it comes to youth violence. And we have 5 mental health workers there, we have substance abuse counselors, and we have a population of less than 100 inmates. And we also have a situation where we know that inmates that have become predatory when they're older probably were assaulted when they were younger, so it's money well spent. Does it sound like I'm defending that cost per inmate? But that's the variation. But the long and the short of it is lower security, lower costs.
Also looking at this brochure on the under inmate population, almost all but 4 of your facilities are over their capacity. All right. So in light of that and perhaps other concerns, one of the questions is, what is the biggest challenge facing corrections, maybe more specifically Nebraska corrections, in the short term and in the long term?
Okay. We're at about 138% of our population. In fact, it's in here. And a overcrowded prison does not mean an unsafe prison. And that when we hit 140% 2 years ago in May, I had a personal conversation with the governor. He says, and of course, when it hits 140%, I had to report that within 30 days. And I told him, you know, our prisons are safe. It's really how you run the institution that makes it safe. Now, when you hit about 155% of your population, you hit a saturation point where you can have the best indicators, the best auditing, and everything else. But you just got too many people. It's like having your relatives coming for Christmas, and they're still there on Valentine's Day, okay? your house has become unsafe. So anyhow, I don't know if that answers your question or not.
It actually is. Well, but let me follow up, because the other part of the question was what are the concerns long term and short term for Nebraska corrections, and not just population, but overall, financially, facilities, you know, training, whatever.
Okay. The biggest thing facing us, of course, is crowding, because if we look at mental health, we'd like to enhance things over time there. Substance abuse, we talked about that. Institutional operations, training of staff, hiring staff, and so those are all things we're always working on and get better at. But one thing, and those are really under our control, and we and the governor's just been fabulous to work with. We're not getting all the resources we want to have, but we're getting all the resources we need to have. But really, crowding, you know, we hit that saturation point, and so we're worried. And so what we're doing is trying to make things safer by crowding our lower security facilities more so than our higher security facilities. So what that means is our community centers have now doubled in their population, whereas before they were overcrowded, but now they're doubled. And now the minimum security facilities are going to start filling up even more. The reason for that is that inmate citizenship is much better at the lower security levels, plus we put people in line to be paroled. So our parole numbers are starting to go up a bit. So that's how we're handling it. And God forbid that I'd talk about a new institution.
Oh, go ahead. I missed this, and I just lost the question. Oh, there it is. Your comments or your thoughts on the legislative bill to move probation into the Department of Corrections?
Oh my. Okay. Well, the point person on that is right here. That's Connie. We've had many discussions. Chief Justice Havlicek and I visited last week, and the governor and I met and talked about this and so forth. So, and we've had a series of meetings with Senator Senewicki on this. As far as creature comforts are concerned, we're trying to get smaller, not larger, okay? And so that's really what our aim is to get smaller. But at the same time, we need to look at this from a perspective of what's better government. And by better government, that doesn't mean that there's going to be lower costs immediately. To have this thing go properly and to sufficiently resource community corrections and to keep people out of prison and have a very viable community punishment, we need to make certain that we spend adequate resources to make certain that we do that. The governor thinks on a much grander scale than what it might cost us now. If you add our budget to community corrections, to probation's budget, now you're talking $210 million a year. That's big money. So if we have to spend a little bit more money now to get what we think is going to be better government to cover the decade, our governor is very attuned to how money works. And so to have community corrections truly resourced the way it should, and if we can contribute to that, that's what we'll do. And the savings comes not in do we need some more probation officers or parole officers now. Where the savings comes in is that if we can keep an institution from being built, which is now, if we built Tecumseh now, would cost us about $110 million, and we spend $30 million a year to run the place. If we can push that off even a year or 2 years or 3 years, and still keep the public safe, huge savings for Nebraska. So I guess the short answer is we're for whatever brings good government.
Well, unfortunately, I have another stack of questions. I have a stack of questions remaining, and we've run out of time. So a few of them will have to be unasked, or if you'd like to chat with Mr. Houston after the meeting, I'd certainly invite you to do that. I'd like to thank our guest today, the director of the Nebraska Department of Corrections, Bob Houston. Thanks also to the KIOS radio station and to the listeners for joining us at this Press Club forum. Once again, my thanks to Bob Houston for joining us today, and we are adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Our guest speaker has been Robert Houston, the director of the Nebraska Department of Correctional Services. He was joined by Connie Nemec, Public Information Officer and Legislative Coordinator for the agency. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, January 24, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be held on Thursday, February 21st at 12 noon. The speaker will be Dr. Henry T. Lynch, Chairman of Medicine at Creighton University Medical Center's Hereditary Cancer Clinic. His topic will be Heredity and Cancer Control. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete noon forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.